Peace. So what I wanted to do is, instead of doing like one episode talking about 50 years of hip hop culture, what I want to do is do a series of little, you know, little buckshots, I guess you can call them, where I give you some reviews of some hip hop books, maybe some documentaries, and some ideas that I have that I wanted to discuss. So I definitely wanted to do that. And I hope y'all enjoy it. So it's going to be a couple of them. So stay tuned. Peace and thank you. Killer tape, Abby. All right, so I know I say hip hop culture a lot. What do I mean when I say hip hop culture? I mean that there's five elements, right? There's knowledge, right? There's writing or graffiti, right? DJing, breaking, and MCing or rapping, right? How did those come about? Well, Afrika Bambaataa, and I know he's persona non grata now. I know he is. Afrika Bambaataa of the Universal Zulu Nation, and I want to say this was 75 or 77. I could be wrong. I'm going by memory now. He said that. First, he said it was graffiti, DJing, breaking, and MCing, that those four elements make up hip hop culture. So when we say hip hop culture, we mean those things. Later on in the early outs, you know, in the early 2000s, Bambaataa said we have to add knowledge to that. So there's five elements, right? So knowledge comes first because knowledge is the foundation. Back in the 70s, that was very controversial because there was a lot of people who didn't consider themselves part of hip hop culture. So for example, Uprockers in Brooklyn or Brooklyn Rock saw themselves as separate from hip hop culture because it was kind of like made outside and then bought into hip hop culture because uprocking comes from gang culture. Number two, graffiti artists did not see themselves as quote unquote hip hoppers. So a lot of graffiti artists, excuse me, which is explained in the movie Wild Style by Lady Pink. That argument is definitely represented by Lady Pink. Shout out to you wherever you are. So I want to be very clear on what I say because you hear me say that a lot. But that's what I mean, because a lot of times when we say hip hop culture, we just think of rapping or MCing and we think of, you know, trunk jewelry and Gucci and all that. And that's not what I mean by that. So let's talk about Kool Herc and let's talk about ADOS. And I'm going to refer to the ADOS several times, probably over and over again. ADOS stands for African Descendants of Slaves. And I know that there is an organization called ADOS, but there are also people who claim the title ADOS, but they're not part of the official group. But it's actually a small fringe movement in the black community of people who believe that, you know, African Americans should be getting reparations from the United States. And they actually are. I consider them to be anti-black because, number one, they're not Pan-Africanist. They don't really have any solidarity with Africans in the diaspora or the continent. So I believe that some of them are agents, but I believe that they're being supported by the conservative movement in the United States. But that's neither here nor there. I want to kind of talk about ADOS and how a lot of people who claim to be ADOS are saying that Kool Herc did not invent hip hop culture. Now, no one has ever said that Kool Herc, you know, Clive Campbell and his sister, no one has ever said that they invented hip hop culture. No one. No one has ever said that they invented block parties. I don't know where this came from, but folks at ADOS are running with it and saying that hip hop culture is an African American creation. It is, and you can find a documentation. I can give you the documents. It is an African diasporic, am I saying that right? Diasporic, from the diaspora, creation. Because you have black people from the West Indies, from the United States, who helped create that, you know, that culture, right? That being said, what Kool Herc did is different from other DJs. Now, he did not invent the block party. Again, people have been having block parties for millennia, right? They just weren't called block parties, right? But what sets Kool Herc apart from other DJs are two things. Number one, DJs in the Bronx used to run power from electric poles, right? Which was illegal, right? Why? Because they didn't have outlets, right? Now, when Clive Campbell's sister, whose name escapes me, I apologize for that, sister, I really do. When she asked him to DJ his party, these are the things that he did different, right? Number one, that community room was not supposed to be used. It was a community room at the bottom of Cedric Avenue, right? It wasn't really supposed to be used for parties, but they did it anyway, right? But what he did was he had two turntables, right? And what he did was he called it the merry-go-round. Now we call it backspinning. And what that is, he took two records, two of the same records, when usually DJs up until hip-hop would use, you know, one record of each. They would have one copy. But hip-hop DJs, they had two copies of the same record, sometimes more. And they would put both the copies, he would put both the copies down on the turntables, and he would find the part that we call the breaks, where just the drums were playing. And he would go from one record, because it would last about maybe 10 to 15 seconds. So he would go from one record, and then as that break beat is about to finish, he goes to the other record and continues. So it was like a continuous beat that he would play back and forth. And that's what sets hip-hop DJs from that era, apart from other DJs, you know? So Kool Herc was instrumental to that. And because of him, a lot of the dances from breakdancing came from, because they were doing it during the breaks. They would only come out during the breaks, right? So that whole concept right there of the hip-hop party, that's something that he put together, right? So I want to be very clear on that, because nobody said he invented anything, right? No one said that. He just, that concept of backspinning or merry-go-round and the concept of the B-boys coming out, he's the one that actually named them. He named them B-boys, right? Which later became Breakers, right? He named them that. So, like, and that's documented as well. So he's crucial in that idea. And remember, these were like grassroots block parties. They were just doing it. They were just running the cables from the light poles, and they were just doing it. So I just want to be real clear about that, because it's really disturbing to hear people say that, and a lot of people debating that online. Again, being very clear about what he does. And when I teach about hip-hop culture, we all have to be very clear about what we mean, because, again, there's always been DJs, right? There's always been MCs, right? But just that in hip-hop culture, we did it differently, right? So before I go any further, definitely Cindy Campbell, I apologize for not knowing your name. I should have known your name, been knowing your name. So like, my bad. I'm not trying to erase you out of history, but yes, Cindy Campbell, we should be giving her love, because she was the one that told her brother she wanted him to DJ her birthday party. And that's what the flyer and everything was for. So really, the idea of the hip hop, you know, the dance, the party, like, she is the one, the genesis of all of that. Shout out to you, Cindy Campbell. Probably in my top 10 movies of all time is Charlie Ahern's Wild Style, which was released back in 1983, which really, quite honestly, is the only definitive hip-hop movie, right? All other movies are about rapping or production or stuff like that, but this one is specifically about the culture as it started in the Bronx, you know what I mean? And it has, it's one of the few movies that, you know, that, like, for example, B Street came out, I think, about a year or two after the fact, and it started a lot of actors who were not participants in hip-hop culture, right? So in Wild Style, Lee Quiñones, a writer, and Lady Pink, also a writer, they're both the stars of this. And also they're supported by Fat Five Freddy, Zafir, another writer, you know what I'm saying, the graffiti writer. You know, even you have, appearances by Blondie. You actually have, you know, appearances by Grandmaster Flash. You have appearances by the Rocksteady Crew. This is just a bunch. You know, Busy B is in it. Like, Busy B plays a big part in it. So, like, a lot of the pioneers, a lot of the greats, a lot of artists were actually starring in this movie. So shout out to Charlie Ahern for that, because later on you see movies about hip hop culture and usually the actors in it are not hip hop participants. They're just actors, which is nothing wrong with that. It's just that it just removed from the authenticity of it. And I think what stood out to me the most when I saw that movie later on as an adult, not as a kid. And as a matter of fact, I didn't see it as a kid. I saw it in the 90s. I didn't see it when it was first released. I saw it in the 90s later on VHS, and I owned it on VHS for a while. But anyway, what was interesting to me was Lady Pink's idea that graffiti is not part of hip hop culture and that people really don't care about graffiti. And I thought that was real, real interesting. And that's an argument that she says to this day, if you could find her in an interview, because it's very difficult to find an interview with her in it. Shout out to Lady Pink. It's really like dope. The scenes are dope. The acting could have been better. You know, like, the acting doesn't stand up. But again, these weren't actors. These were artists. And Lee Quiñones, he plays a graffiti artist who's trying to find his place in the world where people don't respect his art. There's a scene in the beginning, which Nas used for the intro of his first album, Illmatic, where he's sneaking into his apartment. And his brother's waiting for him. His brother's in the army. And his brother's like, hey, you know, what are you doing? You're out here doing this graffiti. This is not art. And he's like, yes, it is. This is art. And it's kind of like hip hop culture seeing itself and wanting respect from the masses as it being an art form. Because back in the 80s, it was not considered that. Matter of fact, in before the 90s, it was considered an art form that wasn't going to last into the 21st century. And here we are. So I think it's like a time capsule. Again, highly recommended. It's fun. You know what I'm saying? You can let the kids see it. I watch it all the time. So definitely Wild Style. Peace. So when folks ask me, you know, what book should I read when it comes to hip hop culture? And the first one that comes to mind, and I know it came out in 2005, but is Can't Stop, Won't Stop by Jeff Chang. And the full title, I want to say Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A People's History of Hip Hop Culture, but it's actually Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation. My bad. I've been saying it wrong for years, but that's a book that, like, everybody should read. Now, again, it's dated. It stops at a particular point, of course, you know, I think like 2003, 2004. But Jeff Chang does a couple of things that's different than any other book on hip hop culture or the history of hip hop has ever done before. He starts in Jamaica, you know what I mean? And then not only does he starts in Jamaica, he also talks about the gang situation in the Bronx before the beginning of hip hop culture. So those two things are crucial, again, especially when you talk about the ADOS, right? Those things are crucial to the discussion of hip-hop culture, because the concept that we have of DJing comes from the island of Jamaica. The idea, again, DJing has been around for generations, but the concept that we have in hip-hop culture actually comes from in the island of Jamaica. Shout out to Kool Herc. And that's something that we have to be clear about. I know I keep saying that, but the book, he starts there and he moves around the country, it's not complete, but I think it's enough. And I think that if you're teaching the history of hip hop culture, this should be your textbook, whether you're teaching it in high school or whether you're teaching it in college. Real quick, there is a children's version that I have not read. I'm gonna pick it up next month because one of my colleagues wants to see if we can use that. But there is a children's version of that book. Again, highly recommended. It's a thick read, but you will go through it quickly. And Jeff Chang, he put his foot in it, man. Like, really, quite honestly, in 2005, it's probably one of the best books to come out that year. But you could find it anywhere. You can find it at your local bookstore. You can find it at the library. I don't know if there's an audiobook version of it. There is an audio. I just never heard it. But I read it twice. Somebody actually stole my copy. I had to get another one. But highly recommend it. And he wrote another book after that, which is good. But this is the one you should start with. Like, this one right here. He does all the interviews and everything. So definitely pick up this Jeff Chang book, Word is Born. First of all, thank you for listening to Where My Killer Tape At. You could have been anywhere else, but here you are. So I appreciate your support. I know I've been saying this every year, but I'm still trying to sell 100 coffee mugs. The link is in there. It's from Cafe Press. Please support the podcast. I wanted to remain as independent as fuck. Now, if you want to continue the conversation, you can do it on Spills or on Threads. And just make sure you hashtag Where My Killer Tape At. Killer is spelled K-I-L-L-A. If you want to get a hold of me, I can be found on Spills at Dan Trezomi, on Instagram and Threads at Brother Omi. And that's B-R-O-T-H-E-R-O-M-I. Dan Trezomi is spelled D-A-N-T-R-E-S-O-M-I. So definitely support. Go to the website, omisbench.com, O-M-I-S, bench, B-E-N-C-H.com. And all my information will be on there. Thank you for supporting the show, and we'll see you next time. Peace.